Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know.
I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Welcome to On the Continent, your definitive guide to the week in European football. I'm Dotun Adebayo.
I'm Andy Brassel.
And I'm Miguel Delaney.
On this edition, City make mincemeat of Real Madrid, but what's the real story, Morning Glory? Also, is this the way to Istanbul for Inter? Or do they have more important issues than a Champions League final to contend with? And has winning La Liga ever felt more like singing the blues for Barcelona? Andy, Miguel, I understand you were both in the place to be last night, which obviously was the Etihad Stadium. How was it for you, Miguel?
Interesting. It was, I've written what I've written, which is putting it in a wider context. Over 15 years in this job, I've seen a lot of great performances, including Guardiola's Barcelona. This was up there in terms of the pure football performance. It's possibly the best ever performance by an English team in Europe. It's possibly Pep Guardiola's best ever performance. And yet, just from sensing the wider discussion about it, the response to it, it just doesn't feel like it's being looked on, or there's not much will to discuss it in those terms, because of course this is all part of a wider context about what the City project is and what's happening to European football. And as I wrote in the piece, I mean, and actually I do think this is an element of it that probably, it's almost, you've got to really zoom out to see it, and which is maybe why it hasn't been discussed as much, but it's pretty much, it's what explains the modern game, really, which is essentially 15 years ago, from around the mid-2000s, a group of states, all specifically motivated by an acutely regional rivalry, saw football as an avenue for expansion, for soft power, for sports washing, whatever you want to call it, but ultimately about diversifying from oil, and allied with the game's increasing embrace of Western capitalism to, I would say, a very corrosive degree, we're now seeing the end product of that. And I don't think it's very healthy for European football. It obviously isn't. But it's interesting that there's a real split in European football now, in that the Europa League has actually been a really healthy competition. And you can see elements of this in the Premier League as well. The Europa League has been a really kind of, there's a variety to it, a competitive vitality. And it's almost like this now, increasingly, this is a separate end of football to what's happening at the very top end, which is increasingly narrower and narrower. And that, this is what's happened. The last night's game, the 4-0, was the perfect representation of this almost, and that how financially stretched football has become, a staggered one. And as soon as it gets stretched and staggered, what it means is, and we've probably mostly seen this with Barcelona, clubs overextend themselves to try and keep up, creating all sorts of further issues. And then we had a situation where Real Madrid, the European football establishment, really, the biggest institution, the old rich, or however you want to describe it, they weren't just beaten, they were destroyed. I mean, that was 4-0, but had it not been for Courtois, it could have been, I think it was Jonathan Liu that had the line, it could have had its own Wikipedia page.
I think that's the thing, isn't it, Miguel? We'll come to Real Madrid and the issues affecting them in a minute, but City was so good. I mean, the first half was just, it was beyond football. It was a different sport. It was absolutely jaw-dropping and unbelievable. But I think when you talk about the gap and I guess the futility of it, the fact is that I'm not sure Real Madrid could have done that much differently. You know, they're incredibly experienced at this level. I think to say off the back of that, as people will be tempted to do, that, oh, Kroos and Modric and Benzema are on the way out. Fine. I mean, they'll be there next year, which is intended to be a handover year for their future. But they defended better, actually, than Bayern did at the Etihad in the last round. Bayern really didn't help themselves. They defended terribly. Real Madrid were as compact as you would expect them to be for the most part. But you can only hold back the tide for so long. And City playing that well, as Miguel was saying, the likes of which I don't think we've really seen in European football for probably a decade, probably since the Barcelona 2011 side. I mean, I think the bit that really captured it in microcosm for me is when City, because you can't keep up that pace for the entire game, had the little 5 minutes sit off, and Real Madrid found a window which would have got them back into the game against other sides, against 99% of other sides. And you saw the bit where Vinicius went off down the left, and at any other point is away. In fact, when he was doing that run against Fernandinho a couple of years ago, he was away, for example. And Kyle Walker not only read him, not only caught him, he used his strength to edge him off to the side, and then he didn't even need to dive in. He just took the ball off him, and that was that. And that was him saying, that was as much as any of the attacking play, Manchester City saying, we are too good for you. And yes, it's about an extraordinary amount of money. It's also, but it's, we have to say, it's money allied to strategy as well. The fact that they set the table for Guardiola to come years before, and Guardiola has been working to this over years, and now I guess they've
they found their footballing nirvana, because I think the way that, if you're in any doubt that Guardiola is the best coach in the world, I think you're kidding yourself, because it's not just that he gets the best out of all different sorts of players. Like Manuel Akanji did not look anywhere near a Manchester City player when he was at Dortmund. We knew he had potential at Basel, but they brought him over and you thought, what are they doing? Why are City signing this guy? Guardiola's turned him into an incredible player. He's made Grealish into what he's wanted him to be, this, you know, incredible competitive beast that stretches things on the left. He's made Kyle Walker better, a player who's heading into his 30s. His coaching on all levels is quite phenomenal.
I completely agree. I think Guardiola's probably the best manager of all time, certainly the most influential, and that's why, and his influence is why, and that's why he's kind of gone past managers like Sacchi, who were influential, but maybe didn't bring that through in the manner that Guardiola has done. And sometimes that gets confused, the argument that, like, oh, by talking about what City are, you're taking away from Guardiola. But that's not the entire point here. City can't just, it's not just that they can afford Guardiola. And let's be fair here, if there was no takeover, Guardiola would not have gone to Manchester City. He went to Manchester City, first of all, because basically they could employ Cheeky Big Eurostein, who he had a certain loyalty to for giving his chance at Barcelona. But also, it wasn't just the course that they got with Cheeky Big Eurostein. They basically got the entire Barcelona. I mean, this, again, we come back to that point I made earlier about 15 years ago, these states looking across the game. Well, in around 2010... they looked across what was the model to follow in football, and it was obviously that Barcelona. So they went and basically brought it over wholesale. And it's not just actually bringing the leadership group over wholesale and all that. They essentially put in perfect, they're able to afford perfect laboratory conditions for probably the greatest manager of all time. And last night, we saw the product of that.
Patrick has tweeted us wondering whether you could put it all down to Real Madrid having a bad day at the office, because Real Madrid, nevertheless, coming runners-up in La Liga, winning the Copa del Rey, you know, doing well in other football competition, including the Super Cup and obviously the Club World Cup as well. Could they possibly just have had a bad day at the office, Andy?
Well, that's what Patrick's question has said, isn't it? That they looked a yard off the pace. I would say that's a product of playing City, and City at a level that we've not seen them touch. I mean, like I said, I think there were bits in the first half where Real Madrid get properly back into the game against a normal team. There's probably the first 15 minutes of the second half where Real Madrid get back into it against a normal team, and that's how polished and complete this City is, that they can do the defensive side of it as well. You know, that's why that you can say that they've reached this apex. But as we were saying at the start, you know, Real Madrid are going through a transitional period. That transition will go the next step up, probably when they sign Jude Bellingham, and you have this Bellingham, Tchouameni, Camavinga midfield, which will be fantastic. I think one of the problems for Camavinga, there was a lot of talk of him playing out of position at left back. The problem is he had nothing in front of him. Camavinga could have done with Camavinga in front of him, I think was the issue. But I think when you talk in terms of resource, Miguel, you just have to look at the benches. Like Real Madrid's bench was populated by a load of players that they don't really want anymore. If you look at Jesus Vallejo, who couldn't hack it at Wolves. You know, you look at Dani Ceballos, who, okay, has played a little bit more this season and has improved, but, you know, is not really a Real Madrid first teamer, I think it's fair to say. Mendy, who they'd like to be shot off, Hazard, you know, Mariano, there's so many of them. You compare that to the City bench, and there really is no comparison. Real Madrid are in a rebuild, and I think it's, if we're talking about the coaches, it's a testament to Ancelotti as a coach that he's managed to get them this far for the last two seasons.
Given everything we've said already, Miguel, is this the end of Carlo Ancelotti, the enigma, if you like, sometimes of football coaching at the top level?
Well, it was interesting. His press conference after the game, he was insistent he's gonna stay. That felt, I mean, some people were calling it denial, and other people were supposed to calling it just a negotiation tactic. even after last week's first leg and for a long time, the feeling has been that by August, Carlo Ancelotti will be the Brazil manager. And you could argue that a move into international football, especially for a manager like that, is kind of moving on to a different stage of his career, finished. I mean, because the club game is the elite level. But that would be my thinking, certainly. I mean, there has been an element of kind of Ancelotti fighting against the tide a bit. It's interesting, like Ancelotti's whole career has kind of been covered in this debate. I mean, his league record has never quite matched his Champions League record. And then, of course, there was the very fact, I mean, his career seemed to be in the decline. That was illustrated by how he went from Bayern Munich, where there was a lot of discussion about how he just couldn't match what Guardiola had done at the club, then on to Napoli. So he goes from Champions League semi-final club, say, to a Champions League qualifying club, then to Everton, a mid-table Premier League club. And Madrid only appointed him, basically, because they're in a touch of desperation that season. And it does just feel that far from being this kind of statement as him being one of the best managers in the world in winning the Champions League last season, it was more just a case of, and this has happened a little bit around Madrid, given what they are as a club, and we will come on to them, he just fit a specific set of circumstances at a certain time. And that happens in management. There's probably more than we care to discuss as we talk about who's the greatest of all time.
I think that's true to an extent, Miguel, but I also think he has done a great job in this second spell at Real Madrid.
He's maximised what's been
there.
Yeah,
he has, but I think we know him as you say, a maximiser of existing facilities, you know, getting the most out of ageing players. But I think what was really notable, actually, last night when City scored the first goal, Vinicius coming over, they had that little powwow in the middle of the pitch, didn't they? They had their circle in the middle of the pitch where they discussed, like, what is happening to us. But the only player who wasn't there was Vinicius, because Vinicius came over to ask Ancelotti, coach, what's going on? You know, I can't be pushed into these defensive positions. I don't know what I'm doing, you have to presume, because he started the game terribly. He looked all over the place. You know, City had him in the best place, 30 yards from his own goal. And I think it underlined the closeness between Vinicius and Ancelotti, because one of the major proponents of him getting the Brazil job is Vinicius, actually.
After it went to 2-0, I think it was, Ancelotti was there kind of drumming his fingers against his mouth, wide-eyed, as if he was stunned by what was happening, didn't really know what to do. And it did remind me of Ferguson in the 2011 Champions League final, which I suppose is what a Guardiola team, and especially a Guardiola team with this sort of backing, can reduce you to.
What about the perhaps even wider picture, which is, you know, we're witnessing essentially, aren't we, a changing of the guard in the powerhouse of European football from the legendary status of Real Madrid and the number of Champions Leagues they've won to, you know, the upstart in a way, never won a Champions League before, Manchester City. Were we witnessing it? Were you aware of that when you're in the stadium, Andy?
I think it's easy to think that on a one-game basis. I mean, the other thing I was thinking of in terms of changing of the guard is City are good as long as Guardiola's there, I think. There are a few little concerns because, of course, the two outstanding players on the pitch against Real Madrid, Gundogan and Bernardo Silva, might not be there next season. And I don't think that's something you can overlook. I think particularly in the case of Bernardo, it's quite difficult to envisage how to replace him. You know, PSG have been credited with an interest. It's something that's been talked about a lot in France this week. And sacrilegious as this will seem to some, in terms of the overall team, Bernardo would be an incredible replacement for Messi and would improve that team. I don't think there's really any arguing with that. But what City have been so good at, actually, and when we talk about their organisation as well as their resource, which are, of course, interlinked, I think you look back at the players who have been totems for them over the last 10, 12 years. Kompany, Aguero, Fernandinho, and they've managed to replace David Silva. They've managed to replace all of them. And they're all players. You think what the trick is for any sporting dynasty, don't let the whole team get old at the same time. And I think it's kind of easy to look at the pitch and think, okay, well, if Gundogan goes, if Bernardo goes, Kevin De Bruyne's 31, and although his best is still amazing, he's slightly less consistent now. But while Guardiola's there, I think you would back him to replace them.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
Of course, the Champions League final is a game of two teams. Let's not forget, wherever we go on this journey to Istanbul, wherever Manchester City go, Inter are waiting for them at the other end, aren't they? I wonder whether, first of all, Miguel, we can start with your impressions of watching the second leg of Inter versus Milan earlier on this week. The week before, it was an amazing, amazing atmosphere in the stadium. This time around, did it equate to that as well?
Oh, the atmosphere was amazing again, and that sense of cultural occasion. And there was almost an element of Inter fans looking to outdo Milan fans in the previous week. I actually felt last week was more about the kind of the sound. This was almost with the feeling of it, in the sense that on more occasions this week, even if maybe it wasn't quite as loud as last week, on more occasions this week, I felt the stadium. It's one of the famous things at the San Siro where the stadium shakes as they bounce. And this happened a few times. It happened as they came, before the game. It happened when the Martinez goal went in, and of course, happened when they won and were celebrating. I didn't think it was as good a game. In fact, as a match, it was probably more like what I expected from the first leg. But I suppose maybe that's because the first leg sort of pretty much set it, and it was always going to take so much from Milan. And that fed into the game itself, maybe. For it to be an occasion in terms of pure football, we needed an early Milan goal. They never really looked like getting it. And in the end, it was Maignan who ended up having to actually to produce the better saves. But still an incredible occasion to be at.
Yeah, from what Miguel was saying there, Andy, it was down to Milan, wasn't it, to really open up the scoring. But they seemed like they were still recovering from that first leg.
Yeah, and we talked about how they were a little overwhelmed by the occasion in the first game. The other thing they were is lacking Rafael Leao, who wasn't really fit We saw that little burst from him down the outside, but that was the only one, really. And it's a shame that we didn't have a fully fit Leao for both of these games. But having said that, I think Inter played it perfectly, as they often have in the Champions League. Now, I talked to someone who was saying to me, well, yeah, well, they've beaten Porto, they've beaten Benfica to get here. You think, well, yeah, hang on. They edged out, they got out of a group that contained Barcelona and Bayern, which no one thought they were getting out of. So they did an incredible job doing that. They've defended very sensibly, despite some variable league form in the meantime, in 2023. And I think that this semi-final has come at the right time for them, really, because their form in the league has been terrific. They've been scoring a lot of goals. They've not really been conceding any. So we've got the best Inter of the season at the moment. And actually, Melvin's written in and said, what case can we make for Inter winning the final? It is difficult. You know, there's a huge gap. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But what I would say is, actually, unlike Milan and unlike Real Madrid, they've got a real variety in terms of attacking possibilities. So, you know, they started with, and you think, you know, give or take, depending on form in between, they'll probably start the final with Lautaro and Edin Dzeko. Dzeko was terrific, I thought, in both games. Not just the goal at the beginning, but in terms of the way he can link play, his passing, his ability to hold it up. But then again, you've got Lukaku and Lautaro, who bring a lot out of each other, who, when they parted for Lukaku to go to Chelsea, were the best front two in Europe. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Then you can throw Correa in the mix. I thought you looked at when, through injury, they needed to bring on Marcelo Brozovic. You know, you're bringing on one of the best midfielders at the World Cup, and he's someone who will run all day and has got an incredible range of passing to control the game. So it's not as if they have nothing going for them. And they have an outstanding goalkeeper. It's not as if they have nothing going for them. And the best of Inter is very, very good indeed. Whether that's enough to beat City is a different question entirely. But, you know, this Inter team aren't any mugs, and I think it's unfair to suggest that.
Miguel, what say you?
I think Inter's chances for this game... Now, Inter as a cup team have impressed me, I have to say. I think they are likely dismissed. But again, we're like, it's two contexts here. On one side, we're talking about like what can happen in football, that Inter are better than we expect. You have to respect what they've become as a team, a certain level of play. And then the other side, we're talking about what City could do to a side as good as Real Madrid. If this game goes normally, City can put in, it can be a final similar to 1989, where Milan destroyed Steaua. Mm. But I suppose the Simeone Inzaghi, one of his great abilities as Inter, I think, has been extracting brilliant individual performances from a series of really good individual players. They've also got a good core through the team that can work through this, particularly in defence with Bastoni and Skriniar didn't play against Milan. DiMarco, I think, has been one of the revelations of the season, one of the best players in the Champions League this season. Then this series of forwards, Lukaku is actually coming back to his best form since he left Inter. Dzeko has been used very intelligently. And all of this can come together in one game. I think that can't be completely discounted. It's just that we're fighting against the reality that if all goes to plan, City should win this comfortably.
All I would say is whatever happens in this final, I find it hard to imagine Inter coming back next season, because it's a little bit like actually when they last won the Champions League in 2010, as we've said before. They're sort of sitting on this financial time bomb, and you know they're running a wage bill that they can't really afford, which is a huge issue. They won't be able to keep Lukaku. They'll probably have to sell one or two more in the absence of any major investment, which doesn't look imminent at the moment. So maybe you're looking at Barella, maybe you're looking at Onana, you know, players that would make a massive difference if they weren't there anymore. So for Inter, it does feel like just a one-off one chance, really.
So on the one hand, there's that Inter with that ticking time bomb, Andy. But what about Milan? On the other hand, their rivals, who they share the stadium with and knocked out of the Champions League. Are they arguably in a better position going forward? Mikel, I don't know if you want to pick up on that first.
Yeah, I do think they are in a much better position going forward, I'd say. I mean, not like you, even the very fact we're talking about how if Inter, if they don't win it this time, that they won't be coming back for some time. They obviously face fire sales potentially at the club of players. But you could almost, weirdly, even though Milan were beaten, you could actually see it in the performance itself. Where Inter were dependent on, you know, a ferocious response from their players in two, okay, not quite one-off games since they were two legs, but you know what I mean in terms of that sense of occasion. But that in itself can be, there's a risk to that because it's almost a potluck of or the circumstances of how you respond. Whereas, and so I was talking to someone who has worked at both clubs in the build-up to the game, and it, like the line that was said to me, I think this is quite astute and interesting in that regard, is Inter's worst is a lot worse than Milan's worst, but their potential best right now is a lot better because of they're based individuals. Whereas Milan are a process team. They're going to something much longer. And increase, this is the way football is going in that regard as well. It's about, I mean, it's one of the reasons why Guardiola has now again surpassed Ancelotti or a lot, because it's about systems. It's a systems game. This is what Milan are trying to interplay, and they're trying to do it incrementally. And that means, unlike Inter, they're not going for these, you know, they've been so cautious and calculating in their approach to recruitment. The only players that got approaching kind of star status are the goalkeeper Maignan and Rafael Leao. And even Rafael Leao, it's conspicuous that he's just signed that new contract. And like the core belief of the club, and this is the actual total contrast to Inter, is that they can gradually and continuously outperform their wage bill. And that is, especially for everything we've discussed in today's podcast about the stratified game, the stretching football, that is how a club like Milan in this modern context succeeds in the long term. So yeah, I would say they're much better set up, but it will lead to disappointments occasionally, like this week.
Where would you rather be, Andy?
I would rather be in Milan's position, definitely. For those reasons that Miguel underlined, and Paolo Maldini, the sporting director now, he said after the game, look, we are not in a position where we can go and spend what we want on players. And that is why it was such a big deal that they were able to lock down Leao. It's absolutely huge for them, especially as the expectation is that they'll get a few more good years out of him and then be able to sell him on for an absolute fortune when he's more developed. And that really is going to be their model, I think, going forward. So that's something that's that they're focused on at the moment. But, you know, they'll have to be smart in the transfer market going forward. I wonder, because they are quite a young team, if even if they miss out on the top four, and there is a possibility that they miss out on the top four, of course, watch this space in terms of what happens with Juventus and a potential another points deduction. We'll have to wait and see. But it leans to me towards keeping Stefano Pioli as coach, because he's someone who's a great leader, really connects with young players, really communicates with them really well, and the detail that he gives the players on their individual performance and their training is something that can genuinely improve them. And having started the pod talking about how really the eventual route to success, the process over many years, is that coaching, that working on the details to make players who are already good better, which is something I think we overlook all the time when we're talking about football, then he's probably the man.
Let's turn to La Liga now, and in particular, the controversial celebration of Barcelona's winning La Liga, but Miguel, winning La Liga not at home, but at the home of their rivals. Do you mind, just if people haven't seen the footage of this, just explaining what happened at the unravelling of La Liga?
I mean, we'll put bluntly, Barcelona did a ring-a-ring-a-rosie in if not the stadium of their greatest rivals, given that's Real Madrid, probably the stadium of the club that hates them more than any other. And while there are obviously massive discussions to be had about, and you know, we've seen so many examples, I think, since football has returned to normal crowds post-COVID, and I think there's been a connection to incidents and kind of the release from that, obviously kind of wider social circumstances about more unrest among fans. And it's something the game has to have a serious discussion about, because these incidents are increasing. And yet all that can be true. And again, it can also be true that don't do a ring, ring, a rosy to really rub it in to your... That's what struck me about the celebration at this point, where you could obviously, if Barca win the game, win the title, there's that spontaneous joy. It's instinctive. It's something you can't really control. I mean, the revulsion of Espanyol fans, I don't think most would have reacted to that. But like, to have this, go into the dressing room and do it. Don't do it on the pitch. And again, I say that while obviously thinking it's a much greater issue that we're having this increasing problem of confrontations and fans encroaching onto the pitch to confront players and managers. But within that, you can still have reservations about what Barca did.
It also goes back to 2007 and the penultimate day of the La Liga season. The Tamudazo, where we touched on it last week when we were talking about Game of the Week, where Raul Tamudo scored the equaliser that allowed Real Madrid, partly allowed, along with Ruud van Nistelrooy's equaliser at Zaragoza, allowed Real Madrid to take control and go on and win the league. And Real Madrid celebrated that Tamudo goal wildly, and so did Espanyol, even though they didn't particularly need the point at the time. So I've heard people say, oh well, it's not a big deal nowadays, it was a long time ago. People remember these things. Football fans remember these things. It's a massive deal to Espanyol to have done that, and it was, as well as being able to win the league itself and at least partly validate Xavi's work since he's come in there a year and a half ago. I think to be able to push Espanyol a little bit closer to the drop was definitely an added bonus for Barcelona, and they were in no way unaware of that.
Yeah, and whatever the protocol about celebrating, and particularly at one of your rivals' grounds, let's just conclude that Barcelona had to leave the pitch very hurriedly because of the response to that. But it wasn't, the celebration wasn't quite the bonfire of the vanities that it perhaps could have been. It felt like the quiet before the storm, almost. This tweet from Ollie: who are the likely casualties at Barca as they look to balance their books ahead of the new season? There will be casualties, won't there?
Yeah, well, I suppose this is one of the great questions. It's yet another juncture season with Barcelona, because, I mean, obviously Busquets is going. So that would mean that De Jong, I think, who's been cast as kind of the player they can get the most money for, given he has been surplus to requirements, or had been seen as surplus to requirements given their midfield options, that seems less likely now. I would wonder whether some of the signings from last year, maybe someone even like Rafinha, because of the expense, some of this has to be reconsidered, because they are going to need some big fees. Ferran Torres, another one that's only come recently, although to be fair, that was in the window before last summer's big controversy. Frank Kessié was again another that came in the middle. And to a certain degree, I think bar about 8 or 9 players, it actually, Barca will have to be pretty flexible about this.
They will, and I think it's going to be harder than they think. It's always harder than you think.
Yeah.
And of course, in the heart of the celebrations, Joan Laporta, the president, was going, yeah, we think we've got a great chance of signing back Messi. They've got so many sums to do before they can get to that point. The question is, how long will Messi wait? And might I suggest, if you're Messi, you might not feel like waiting, given that 2 summers ago, he waited and waited and waited to sign a new contract. And at the end of it, they said, actually, we can't afford you. Bye-bye, club legend. I think that would live in your head a little bit. So whether Messi's prepared to run the clock for them, I really don't know. And we'll have to wait and see. But all the players that they want to try and sell, the players that they feel have good value, like ones they got on freeze that they feel they can make pretty much pure profit from, like Kessier, Christensen, as has been suggested, Rafinha, they did pay a big fee for, but presumably they think they could sell him back to a Premier League club. The players have to agree to go, as we already saw through Frankie de Jong last season. And that is really hard. It's not quite the same thing as the Premier League or PSG, where you're struggling to shift players who are on massive wages. You have got players who have been prepared to turn a blind eye to the mess that Barcelona has been off the field because they so badly want to play for Barcelona. And that is the issue here. You know, Rafinha could have easily gone to Chelsea and made himself more money, but he decided to go to Barcelona. And with him particularly, who's had a good season, by the way, it was very pointed how he came out after the Supercopa de España in Saudi Arabia and said that this was just off the back of rumours of them selling him in January, saying, well, I hope this is the first of many trophies for Barcelona. I'm going to stay here and win lots of trophies. Which is basically him saying publicly to the club, well, try and sell me, because I ain't going anywhere. And if a player doesn't want to go, as we saw with Frenkie de Jong, and they tried a few different things to get him to go, those players won't go. So creating this liquidity for Barcelona, I think, is very, very difficult indeed.
Yeah, Miguel, what a lot of people want to know is whether there's any truth to the possibility that Messi would return to Barcelona, as Andy's indicated there. I don't understand why it's even mooted at this point, but there are obviously reasons. Do you have any insider knowledge on this or not?
Well, Xavi's been in contact with Messi. The club haven't actually made a concrete offer. Last I heard, which was not that long ago, they hadn't even approached the Messi's about a potential deal. So at the moment, that is just crazy. A non-starter.
Why is it a discussion point if it's a non-starter?
Well, I suppose because of the romance of it, it would seem logical. Obviously, part of Messi would want it. But while I think there is a certain... Obviously, it'd be great to see Messi get the farewell he was denied that last season with the knowledge he was going, that he was denied in 2021. There's also a sense, though, that Barca have pulled off the Band-Aid now. I mean, it's a bit bigger than a Band-Aid, given we're talking about the greatest player of all time. But they've gone through the hard part, and they still have issues. So to me, this would be a case of, more than ever in football, emotion overriding logic.
Andy, do you agree with that?
That's the issue, really. That they should be relieved to not have him on the wage bill anymore. I mean, it's not going to help the team advance. Of course, it's a beautiful story, I suppose, and you know, you want to give him his gold watch, metaphorically speaking. But how it helps the team, I don't know. What they've got to do to become more financially sustainable, and bear in mind they're just about to go into a season where they're not playing in Camp Nou, which is going to be difficult for them. They've got to make strides in the Champions League, because there's a certain emptiness to winning this league, because they didn't come anywhere near in Europe. And that is what the whole financial deal was predicated on. I think it's quite interesting that we've had both the two big departures that they didn't really want is Matteo Alemanni, the sporting director, who was so instrumental in being creative in the transfer market to help them get some of these players on board when it looked like they couldn't afford anything. And yes, financial levers, but in terms of structuring the deals, in terms of negotiating the deals, in terms of persuading players to backload contracts, where they get paid a certain amount at the beginning and more at the end, which is not brilliant for the financial health of the club, you might argue, but it persuaded players to come and it not to cost the earth in the short term. He's going, and Jordi Cruyff has announced this week that he's going as well. So they're losing management that did a lot to make Laporta's dreams come true against the odds. And I think it's a concerning sign that the money men around Laporta, the creative minds, are saying, and it happened pretty soon after he was elected, are basically turning around and saying, we don't believe this can work, so we're out. I think that's a real concern if you expect them to make any headway in the Champions League.
As fascinating as the conversation has been today, gentlemen, needs must, and we must needs ask you both to recommend a game of the week for us. Who wants to go first? Miguel, do you fancy having a crack at that first?
Yeah, I can go picking up from, I suppose, everything we've been discussing. And I go for Milan-Sampdoria, given one of the great intrigues. I mean, it's how Milan respond, and especially because if they don't respond in the right way, then they won't be back in the Champions League next season. This could complete it. So, yeah, I think it's an absolutely huge game in that regard. And I will be accompanying it with some gnocchi.
Well, very Michel Platini.
Yeah.
And how about you, Andy? What would you recommend for us, and what would you eat with it?
I'm going to go for Saturday evening, 5:30, Bayern versus Leipzig. Two games left in the Bundesliga, 1 point between Bayern and Dortmund at the top. We're at Dortmund, recording at the match last weekend as they beat Borussia Mönchengladbach, and you know that they still believe that they can win it, but they need an assist, and this is the weekend that it all comes down to, really, because Leipzig are the remaining team who you would fancy to take points off Bayern. Maybe they don't need it quite as much after they beat Werder Bremen late on, and Freiburg lost last weekend, so they've got a 4 point gap and a better goal difference in the Champions League race. But they're in decent nick, and they're a good opponent for Bayern, so that will be interesting. The following day, Dortmund go to Augsburg, and Dortmund not great on the road in the last couple of months. So that's the issue. But, you know, they'll know what they have to do by then. And either way, I think Bayern versus Leipzig is going to be fantastic. Two really good teams, and it should be exciting. And maybe it can breathe a little bit of extra life into the title race as well. So to go with that, I'm going to have some more of the currywurst that ended up on my shirt last weekend.
Yeah, well, you'll eat that on your own, mate.
Football Ramble is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Anna Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, and join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.